Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More Americans are playing video games than ever before, at least 155 million of them. And the average player isn't a kid, but 35 years old. All kinds of adults playing. Some researchers say lower-skilled men are working less and gaming more. They're at higher risk of financial instability and drug use, but surveys show they're happier. All this as video games draw more revenues than movies and sophisticated new consoles and games are rolling out. This hour On Point, the adult video gamer in America and what they're seeking and finding in all those games. World of Warcraft, Legends of Azeroth behind us right here. You can join us online or on air where this conversation is always on. Are you a gamer? Does it make you happier? Do you see friends enhanced by gaming? Escaping to gaming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is Frank Guan, music columnist for Vulture, New York Magazine's entertainment site. He's also a gamer and wrote a big story for the site called Why Ever Stop Playing Video Games, which you can link to at our website, onpointradio.org. Another headline on that story, video games are better than real life. Frank Guan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
This was really interesting. So you sort of took the, what there was the professor last summer who stood up at graduation ceremonies out in Chicago and said, hey, heads up, we've got young American men pulling out of the workforce and migrating into video games. And he spoke about it in pretty dire terms. You've come out as a longtime gamer to say what, Frank?
Well, I've come out to say mostly that I would say I'm a little. I found the professor like he's a business school professor at the University of Chicago's School of Business, which is like top ranked in the world and everything. And I found it interesting that the professor kind of tied the he tied his argument about video games replacing labor into like a larger narrative about, you know, like automation basically like replacing manufacturing jobs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he was making the argument, you know, even as technology has removed people from the work, like has removed people from the industrial workforce, it's also like by making entertainment that much more appealing, it's offered workers an opportunity to like, it's basically made leisure that much more attractive over labor.
Right.
And I found the argument a little disingenuous, probably not intentionally. I'm sure he did it all in good faith and everything. But it seemed to me that, you know, there are other reasons why people can't find work or they can't find satisfying work or whatever, other than, you know, just that, you know, the games are too fun or whatever. And you know, that kind of led me to, you know, and the professor is not he wasn't very articulate at all about the actual subjective experience of video games because he wasn't a gamer himself, you know.
Right. But he didn't care. To him, it was like they're not finding work. They're laying around. They're playing video games. We've got a problem here.
Right. He was like, you know, even though these people, you know, report themselves as being on average happier, you know, like the less they work, the harder it will be to find work. And, you know, before you know it, 10 years down the line, these people, you know, they might be voting for, you know, dangerous, you know, people who, you know, promise to, you know, give them like social subsidies or whatever. So it was very like ingeniously tied into this, to this general argument about, you know, like people being a drain on, you know, welfare and so on and so forth. So I found it very interesting.
The numbers he was looking at were these, and the Washington Post and others have reported them as well. You do as well. As of last year, I guess this is actually 2015 now, 22% of men, American men between the ages of 21 and 30, with less than a bachelor's degree, reported not working at all in the previous year. 22% of those 21 to 30, that's a lot. And that's up from 9.5% back in 2000. So more than doubled in that period of time.
Yeah.
And then they say here, overall, only 88% of men between the ages of 25 and 54 are working or looking for work. Now, 88% sounds like quite a few, but that leaves 12% not even working or looking for work. And that is the third lowest among 34 developed countries, those American numbers. So we're right down at the bottom of the pile there. Young men without college degrees, they're reporting, have replaced 75% of the time they used to spend working with time on the computer, mostly playing video games. What do you see going on there, Frank? Is this escapism? Is this building some kind of alternative or other life that's worthy? Is this a crisis or is this a new way of being?
I mean, I suppose we could say the same thing about, you know, the rise of television in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You know, it does seem like this gigantic, shift in the national culture, you know, basically being conducted by, you know, a giant change in entertainment. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to say. My suspicion is just that, you know, it's very hard to know where the feedback loop begins with these things. You know, if you're a young guy and you know you haven't gone to college or you've graduated from college and there's no work out there, you know, it's going to be very hard to fill the time with you know, anything. There are a lot of hours in the day to fill, and video games might well be like a very cheap way to, you know, pass the time in a more pleasurable way than, you know, you can probably find elsewhere in your life. And, you know, as somebody who, you know, was not employed for, you know, several years after graduating from college, you know, I definitely understand that impulse. But at the same time, the games can be so addictive that, you know, you can stop looking for work at a certain point and, you know, it can be dangerous, I suppose, in that sense. But then you have to wonder, you know, I think what video games provide better than anything else is any other entertainment is a sense of personal achievement. Like you can watch, you know, TV or movies and you can experience a kind of vicarious satisfaction, a kind of vicarious victory. But in games you actually do win. And that is victory is very hard to find in real life. It's not evenly distributed. And, you know, games offer the prospect of a world where you actually can come out on top. And, you know, for a lot of people, you know, and it's not just, you know, people from the working class, you know, but increasingly people from the middle classes, you know, the labor market shrinks for young people especially, you know, that it may well be a logical decision. And I don't think it's some kind of a social epidemic or anything like that. You know, if anything, I would suspect games make people more passive and less likely to indulge in things that would actually be dangerous, like, you know, politics or whatever.
Dangerous or necessary or both.
Yes.
I mean, but this point is where your piece got really interesting to me, where you take us into the texture of the feedback loop there. I mean, you say a bunch of really interesting things. One, you write, there will always be a tawdry, malformed aspect to gaming. Surely human beings were made for something more than this. Yes. But then you write, Frank, you say, we turn to games when real life fails us, not merely in touristic fashion, but closer to the case of immigrants fleeing a home that has no place for them, fleeing, I guess you're saying here, to a digital realm where they can find something that feels more like meaning, is certainly something that feels more like victory, or as Donald Trump might say, winning.
Yes. I would say that, you know, I would suggest that, you know, human beings need a certain amount of victory in their lives the same way they need food, water, or air. And, you know, if they can't find it, they really like the effects are almost as drastic as, you know, like missing out on calories or oxygen. So, you know, I think what games can offer is, you know, a chance to at least temporarily satisfy that lack. But, you know, obviously in the long term, it is a bit like drinking salt water to, you know, cure your thirst. Like you do drop out of the world and into a pretty, an entirely different world. But it's not actually that different because, you know, I think the heart of my piece is just is making a rather simple statement that, you know, games are at heart these economic engines, that they are to economics what, you know, rap is to race or what, you know, pornography is to gender. Like that's just the, you know, you can't have a game without resource management, basically. Like that's what ties the entire thing together.
You mean the dynamics are economic dynamics, even if they don't produce a penny for
right.
most players, but it's
right.
all about acquiring and playing a game, a sophisticated game very often, of economics within the game rules.
Right, which was what made the fact that an economics professor, you know, couldn't understand what was going on in video games. You know, that was kind of what made it interesting to me. That and the fact that his son couldn't, you know, his
own son
like
couldn't stay off the games. But his right. worry was that they would be pursuing all of this economic life in the form of a game that had no right. real-world payout, and they end up with no finances and no career and marooned in the digital realm.
Yes, that sounds about right. I guess what I was saying is that you know, video games have, like, once enough people buy into something, like the value system becomes large enough that, you know, people can people can actually live off of that. Like they can derive enough meaning just from that region of culture of their lives, basically. Like
to make it all work. Frank, you know, hold the thought. We're new terrain here, and I want to come back and look at it. Frank Guan is with us from Vulture. Listeners, you can join us this hour. Is that you racking up more hours on the old console, on the new console? Are you that American adult with a video game passion on the side or even central? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's Lana Del Rey with video games. Her lover plays video games, and she later ends up gaming too. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point.
Kissing in the blue dark, playing, pulling wild dots, video games. He holds me in his big arms, drunk, and I am seeing stars. This is all I think of. Watching all our friends fall in and out of old clothes. This is my idea of fun, playing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American adults playing more video games for more hours, sometimes instead of work and career, and what that means. What's going on in there? Super Mario theme behind us here. Mario will return to the gaming universe in the game Super Mario Odyssey, which will be released on Nintendo Switch, coming out end of this week. You can join us this hour. Are you among those who invest your time, your life, deeply in the video game world? What's it about for you? Is it about escape, recreation, entertainment, challenge? Can you picture adults who find more satisfaction in their gaming life than their real life? Is that you? And is this a healthy, mind-building pastime? Is it a copping out or a stepping up in the real world? Frank Guan is with us from Vulture, music columnist there, but a longtime gamer himself. He's been writing very interestingly about what's going on when a lot of American adults turn heavily to gaming. Among those, certainly plenty who are working, but among those, Americans who have almost dropped out of the working world, this is their realm of satisfaction, many hours a week. Frank joins us from New York. Frank, interesting, lots of people writing in for you, for us. Megan writes, I used to play with my father when I was little, and video games were a solace. When my father passed away, Megan writes, games are a cheap way to explore, I guess. If I had more money, I'd be out traveling. But instead, I'll settle for exploring digital worlds since they are much cheaper. I mean, there's another kind of economic view of what's going on there in a generation that may not have those resources out of their working life. And here's another from Dallas. Dallas says, I'm 26 years old from rural Iowa. My friends have scattered all over in the last few years. We all work full-time jobs. Some of us do better than others. Some of us have families. Some don't. But we all want to unwind in the evenings and just hang out with our old buddies. And Dallas writes to us, says, I can honestly say that the friends I play video games with are my closest friends at the moment, and that being able to log on and play provides a much-needed social connection that we would otherwise only be able to organize maybe a few times a year if we all met up in person. This isn't just a lonely life out there, Frank. There's a lot of socializing that goes on now in this realm as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like games provide a context, you know, that's fairly easy to it's actually very – it's designed to, so that you can, like, share it with other people, basically. And, you know, it's definitely not the case that, you know, like, all gamers are, like, completely isolated and just, like, facing up to the game. You know, like, some gamers are like that. I would say I'm probably closer to that than to, you know, spending time with people playing games. But, no, I definitely think it's a great way to, like, to form social bonds or, like, maintain social bonds with people. Like I also do that, too, you know. So it I mean, simply by providing like a general, it provides a general context, you know, like it provides something that, you know, is a lot harder to organize in real life, I guess, which is, you know, you can actually get together and you actually know what you're supposed to be doing together, you know, and it's definitely more interactive than, you know, like watching like a TV show together or something like that. So,
You write about what games offer that the rest of the world does not, cannot these days. Take us through some of that thinking.
Well, I think what games offer, you know, like we've gone over, you know, the fact that they provide achievement, but, you know, they provide
a structure for achievement, I guess.
Yeah, a structure for achievement and a structure for, you know, like ranking yourself among people. And it feels like unless the game is actually rigged in some way or another, or other people are hacking the game, you know, like the game is fair, and the rules are relatively clear. Like not all the rules are obvious in a game, but a lot of them are, and the others you can you can kind of figure out by playing, and that's not something everybody has access to in real life. You know, like it takes a lot of social capital. It takes a lot of unspoken rules, basically a lot of shibboleths that are not going to be apparent to people, especially as, you know, the world kind of splinters into, you know, like 1,000 separate smaller spheres. So, you know, that's something that games are very upfront about, and, you know, I think people appreciate it. And the other thing is, you know, like you can opt into, like you're choosing to play video games. Nobody's forcing you to play video games. Whereas, like with labor, like you basically, unless you're like really like slumming it or something like that, you know, you are forced into the labor market basically, and that's, you know.
So you have agency in a way, in the sense that you're deciding to play a game and which game and when, and so it's all your own agency, your own choice.
Exactly.
Wow. All of this really gets our attention at a time where people are talking about more and more automation coming into play, asking what humans are going to be doing. And I came away from Frank Gwan's piece in Vulture, Video Games Are Better Than Real Life, thinking maybe this is where some part of the population goes. Danielle Riendo joins us in just a moment. She's a gamer, been playing since childhood, and managing editor at Waypoint, that's Vice's Guide to Gaming. But I want to get a couple calls here first. Barkley in Oilton, Oklahoma. Barkley, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Frank Gwan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your experience?
Well, I am a working adult. I'm 23 years old, and I hold a full-time job, and I thoroughly enjoy video games, mostly for, like, the cultural experiences. I play a game called Smite, which is, like, a mass multiplayer battle royale-style game. And I've made friends with people from Puerto Rico, from Alaska, as well as what I find most interesting, an American foreign exchange student who's currently in Beijing.
Wow.
I'm playing on the North American server.
Okay, all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, do you really make friends with them, or do you just battle them, you know, on a digital field?
Well, it's actually interesting. The American foreign exchange student and my friend Jesus from Puerto Rico, they were actually my teammates, just in a random match. I got put in with them, and we started talking and communicating and had a real good, enjoyable time. Two separate games for both of those friends. But what's most interesting is my friend from Alaska, Tommy. I was actually his opponent in that game, and he messaged me after I pulled a victory on him. He messaged me, he's like, hey, man, you're really good. We should friend start each other on the PSN on PlayStation. And so we did, and we began playing as teammates. So So it kind of brought two opponents together, recognizing each other's skill, and became friends from that. And we've been friends ever since.
Barkley, you're 23 years old. You're working full time and have this rich gaming life. It sounds overall to you that it enhances your life. What about people who aren't out there working, for whom this becomes their primary source of meaning or even economic structure, though it doesn't pay them? Do you worry about them, or is this, you know, if people are underemployed or unemployed, is it a net positive somehow, Barkley?
I do worry for them, because I mean, you know, it goes back to the old adage, you know, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. I mean, Video gaming is fun, it's relaxing, it's equal parts relaxing and exciting. You get an adrenaline rush during a good game. But if you do it too much, it does take away from your personal life, it can ruin your financial situation. And then overall, if you let it consume you, it does become a bad thing. But I think that's where the people around you step in, you know. Like I said, I'm a working adult, I have a full social life, and I do play video games. And I would love to play video games more because I enjoy them, but I also realize that I have different responsibilities outside of life, and I'm constantly reminded of that by my friends and my family and different social interactions that I've got going on at the time. I think if you get rid of the social interactions, then it does become sort of like an addiction, and it can be very disruptive.
Barkley, I appreciate your call from Oklahoma. Let me get one more right here, Frank, from Florida, Tampa, Florida. Barkley, thank you. Robert in Tampa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been gaming for 20 years. I've had friends who have been movie stars, football players in the NFL, people all around the world in all walks of life. I've had drug addicts as friends. I've had...
I mean, friends through gaming, you're saying, Robert.
All through gaming. And the relationships I've built is just as real as the people that my next-door neighbor or the people I work with. I know about their children. I'm friends with them on Facebook. We get together in Las Vegas or in Orlando or you name the area. We just get together to have some fun if we're traveling for business, because most of us are working adults. I mean, almost everyone I know who I game are and actively contributed. We have police officers. We have firefighters. We have everything you can think of that we play with, and they're just as much a part of our reality as you are to the person that's in the room with you.
Robert, is it different than being in a movie club together and watching the same movies, or being in a book club and reading the same books? Is there something more depth or bonding about gaming together?
I would say it's almost the same. It's a mutual, you know, enjoyment of what you're doing. I mean, regardless if you're reading a book and commenting on the book or watching movies and commenting on the movies and how well they are, in this particular case, we're getting to, you know, kill a dragon or shoot up an Afghan tank or whatever game that is your stick is what you're doing. And there's so many different genres of games out there that it's really an unlimited choice assortment of fun.
It sounds like it's working for you, and I'm really glad to hear from you, Robert, in calling from Tampa. Thank you very much for that. Frank Guan, stand by there in New York, also with us from New York, now from Brooklyn, is Danielle Riendo. Gamer, managing editor at Waypoint, that's Vice's Guide to Gaming, teaches video game design at Berklee College of Music. Danielle, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. I'm very excited to be here.
What do you think of this deeper enmeshing of American adults in the realm of video gaming? Where are we going here, Danielle?
I actually think we're going to a lot of very, very exciting places. And I really enjoyed the piece by Frank, but
yeah, me too.
There are aspects of video gaming that weren't discussed at all in that piece.
Okay,
take
us.
That I'm personally most excited about are games that are from tiny studios, even single creators, you know, women, people of color, queer people who are actually making very personal work, stories from their lives in video game form. There's an entire platform out there called itch.io where there are hundreds of games, thousands of games maybe. Many of them can be played for free. This sort of personal and expressive work is probably the thing I'm most excited about, and the thing that really, really, I don't know, I guess there's sort of a sense of these are for everybody. They're not just for young, underemployed men or you know, the sort of solipsistic idea of, you know, a young man sitting alone at his computer.
Give us a sense of these more personal, expressive, individual games. What is it even? What kind of experience or what kind of challenge?
Absolutely. They're not always challenges. Oftentimes, these games take a form of a very sort of interactive story. Maybe it's in a 3D space where you're exploring something. The sort of sterling example of this, something I enjoyed very much from 2013, was a game called Gone Home, where you're exploring a family home in the 1990s. And it's sort of set up as almost a mystery game. Oh, what happened here? Why is the family not here? And it ended up being a very warm, very personal story about a young woman coming out as a lesbian, basically. Not something you necessarily expected from a video game.
Is there a gaming aspect to it, like, you know, to somehow conquer and win or empathize and win? Or what's the dynamic of it?
Winning is understanding what's happening.
Okay.
Which I really, really love games that sort of subvert
that. That's cool.
I love games that subvert the winning or killing or conquering. Certainly love those games as well. I think there's a place for those. But there's a lot of games that are twisting that around, doing something a little different than that. There's a game that just came out a couple of days ago, actually, called Night in the Woods. And this is a game about, it's very playful in tone, but it's about essentially a young woman who drops out of college and goes back to a sort of depressed Rust Belt town, her hometown, and sees what happened to all the people there, if they grew up or not, basically. I'm enamored with this kind of work. I think it speaks to a much deeper level. I think it speaks to people's, you know, personal stories and personal experiences.
What's the role that you see emerging for video games as they become more sophisticated, some in very grand ways of conquering and killing and all the rest, lots of that, but also in these very personal, expressive ways? I mean, again, quoting Frank here, this phrase, we turn to games when real life fails us, you know, like immigrants fleeing a home that has no place for us. Do you see American adults spending more time in this realm for their life satisfactions? What's coming?
Well, I think a lot of things are coming. I'm excited that games can be more. Games are so much more than just, you know, sitting down at an old console in the 80s and just sort of beating bad guys. They can be these grand, beautiful visions. There's a game called Horizon Zero Dawn that came out this week that is sort of a bigger budget action game. But it also has a lot of bits of personal storytelling in it. You can kind of go around and meet all these factions of people, and they all have different types of societies. There are matriarchal societies. There are kingdoms. There's all sorts of kind of different things going on and personal stories with the characters in that world. So I think on the grand level, on that sort of grand cinematic level, and on this very tiny personal, you know, one person to three person studio types of games, there's everything, and it's all growing. And I think there's room for all kinds of play and all kinds of people to experience this and form communities around different types of games.
Frank, are you ready to go there, to the very personal, the very expressive, away from the you know, huge multiplayer conquer the universe games?
Well, I mean, I would be happy to go there, honestly. I think for myself, you know, as someone who's trained, you know, who has kind of a literary background, who started out as a literary critic and then somehow ended up writing about music and then video games, you know, like I've always felt that literature was enough in terms of like personal expression and in terms of that field of, you know, thing. So I feel like I've kind of specialized in that direction for any kind of, you know, if I actually like thought any, I always assumed if people had something to say that they could say it, you know, like in a novel or in poetry or whatever, or in a personal essay. But, you know, I think it's great that, you know, people are developing these like very small, like intimate games that are, you know, that can, I think that they can kind of shift the system of incentives that, you know, that is essentially the skeleton of a game, you know, to accommodate, you know, other experiences and other views. I think that's fine. I'm not sure like those games like have the same kind of like financial like clout as, you know, like the larger games out there, which is why, you know, it was hard to, you know, incorporate that into the, you know, general narrative of the piece. But, you know, I'm thrilled that, you know, indie games are out there and, you know, that there's like a tremendous, you know, variety, you know, within them.
We've got more questions about what's coming in the gaming realm, the role it's playing in American life, in American adult life. Frank Guan with Vulture, please stand by there in New York, and Danielle Riendo in Brooklyn, managing editor of Waypoint. That's with Vice, their guide to gaming. Listeners, you can join us this hour. We're talking about American adults and the video gaming realm. What about the social side of video gaming? Is it isolating, enriching? Is it like poker night or different? Are you up for the latest and greatest? Are you ready to snatch up Nintendo Switch later this week? Some rappers, we're at 800-423-8255. Some rappers are singing about the influence of video games. Don't always like it. Here's 2016's No Heart. 21 Savage talks about how he was playing with guns while other kids were playing video games. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This until I pull up on them, slap them out with the fire. Witch them on my house, witch up around my house. Keep shooting until somebody die. So many shots, the neighbor looked at the calendar. Thought it was 4th of July. You was with your friends playing Nintendo. I was playing around with that fire. Sound great, I got caught with a pistol. Send me the Pantherville. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American adults playing more video games for more hours, sometimes instead of work and career, and what that means. What's going on in there? Nintendo coming out later this week with Switch. New console coming out. Bunch of retro games there, including Sonic. One of those featured on Nintendo Switch out this Friday. Frank Guan is with us from Vulture, New York Magazine's entertainment news site. He's been writing about what people find in this realm. He sees them very often as immigrants to the world of video gaming. He says, we turn to games when real life fails us. Some may say just to enhance life. For others, it may be, failure and off they go. How do you see the role of video gaming evolving in American adult lives? Danielle Riendo is with us as well. She's managing editor at Waypoint. That's Vice's guide to gaming. Joins us today from Brooklyn. Chris Grant joins us in just a moment from Polygon, but lots of callers here. Susan in Bloomington, Illinois. Susan, good to have you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The reason I called is because I feel that it's kind of a shallowing of a question to ask, what do you like about video games or what does it mean? When to me, it kind of takes aspects from reading, from something like sports, and then also from social media. So it's kind of a mishmash of all of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
I've actually got what I would call adopted family from playing a video game way back almost 10 years ago now, to the point where they moved to where we live to be with us as family. And now...
Get out. You mean because you played video games together and then you sort of moved into the...
Yes.
Moved to be near each other? That's incredible.
Yes, she moved up. One of our dear friends, she became like a sister to my husband who lost his own biological brother very early in life.
Yep.
They moved all the way to where we live to be with us as family.
What game got them so close, Susan? What was the game that was the...
EverQuest 2. It's an MMO, a massively multiplayer online game.
Yeah.
But there you kind of have the social aspects that you see in social media, the better parts of social media. You have a lot of the storytelling that we all like about books. And then you have kind of the cooperation that one would get with sports, and it all kind of comes together and you form these really intense bonds with some people.
So all in all, you find it a net plus. The people who worry, oh, this is a new kind of reefer madness, so they're lost out there in the caves.
No, they don't. I don't think they really have entered the world and seen the actual people that inhabit that space. I mean, you've always got some negatives.
Yeah. Susan, we've got it loud and clear, and I really appreciate your call there from Bloomington. One more right here from Georgia, Augusta, Georgia. Stephen, you're on the air. What's your experience?
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been playing video games since I was 5. I started with my older brother, and then as I grew up, we try to get the new consoles as they come. But now as a working adult, I'm in the military, and I'd say at least 50% of every command I go to, that's at least gamers, 50% of them. We use it as a coping mechanism after like a long, stressful day.
Okay.
And it is escapism, but it's a way to deal with stress because that's safer than going out and drinking, you know? And, I build camaraderie. Like my brother, he's also in the military, and my best friend, and we're all in different states across the United States. And so the best way for us to contact each other and hang out is through video games, and we'll play, and we'll chat, and we'll talk about life, and we'll try to slay the dragon or take down the enemy team.
And so that's your way to chill, and also, as Susan says, socialize at the same time, get into a challenge better than drinking. Got it, Stephen. I appreciate your call. One more here, and I'll bring it back to our guest, Christopher, in Griswold, Connecticut. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This has been an ongoing thing, no matter through any generation, through gaming. It's always gotten a lot of bad rap for what was said previously. But I'm an occupational therapy assistant. I hold 3 jobs. I have a house. I have a wife. I've been gaming my entire life ever since Nintendo and Atari first came out. And that's been my disconnect. That's been like, okay, I need to take a break. I need some time alone. You know, this is my disconnect where I can go and I can be the hero, especially with my, I had a rocky childhood, mainly due to the bullying and through grade school.
Okay.
And,
yep.
the same class for 9 years. So I'd go home and one of my favorite titles was Zelda. And, I was the hero in that. I could actually go in there and, you know, save the princess, if you will.
Yeah. When you say disconnect, you mean that in a good way, Christopher. It's a way to regenerate or take a break.
Correct. Yes, it's a way of okay. You know, I had a really rough day. You know, people were kind of. I need to take my 15 minutes. Whereas some people, they'd go shopping or use less appealing things like drinking, smoking, even drugs or whatever. They could turn to that. Whereas I have made the connection with video games and gaming, and I can go in there and say, okay, here's my 15 minutes, here's my hour, you know, that I have at home, and I can stay here, I can game, and I can relax. And then now I can go out and I can finish the rest of my time. I can finish, you know, whatever I need to do for the day. So it's nice to come home to that. And also the social aspect of it, I have I've met people from Australia, Romania, Russia, and throughout those, one of them was actually lived close to me, and I got him to come down. He was one of the ushers in my wedding as well.
Wow.
Social aspect, it really, really, really is part of it.
So it works. A hero in Zelda and a sort of restoration for life. Christopher, I appreciate your call as well. Danielle, what about, though, the Chicago professor's lament that American adults, young men, less educated in particular, are less present in the workforce, almost at the bottom of the heap in terms of industrialized countries, third from the bottom, and a lot of them are spending a lot of time playing video games. And he's you know, warning that they're not creating there a life that will sustain them over time. You know, they're going to be in trouble in economic terms, in career terms. He sees it as a kind of a net loss zone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly not a researcher. I certainly haven't done this particular research itself.
I don't know that he has either. I think he's just looking at the numbers and saying, oh, my God, this looks like trouble to me as a business school professor. Him.
Certainly. I always wonder about the factor of is unemployment down across all sort of demographics, or are we looking at, specifically only among just one demographic? Are we looking at, you know, other factors like TV? Are we looking at movies? Are we looking at other types of entertainment? Are we looking at gaming on a person's phone while they're in the subway? There's a lot going on there. And, you know, again, not a researcher, but I would caution against making games the enemy. That's sort of something that's been happening since there have been video games. And
yep.
One caller even, you know, specifically said this, since the rise of TV, you know, since the rise of the internet, since the rise of certain types of music, rock and roll music, that sort of thing. I don't think scapegoating is the best idea. And I also don't think that games are inherently solipsistic, which so many folks already have said. You know, the social aspect is incredibly important. Even one-player games, like something that was actually in Frank's piece, a game called Life is Strange, which is a sort of essentially an adventure game where you're playing as a young woman, a high school woman who has this sort of special power. That game, I played it entirely with my girlfriend, with my partner, and we discussed every decision we were making in the game. We live streamed this game for a community of other people who are interested in this sort of game.
Yeah.
So it's very much a social endeavor that I think, you know, certainly there are negative aspects of gaming culture, but there are also a lot of positive aspects. And there's a lot of folks who have come together around games, and I'm very heartened by that.
Danielle Riendo, please stand by there in Brooklyn, and Frank Guan in New York. I want to go to San Francisco right now. And Chris Grant, he's editor-in-chief of Polygon. That's Vox Media's gaming website. Covers video games, creators, fans, industry trends. He is attending the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco this week. Chris Grant, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
What's coming, Chris? If these games are so engrossing already, Where are we headed here? And let me ask you in particular about a piece that's it was in Wired last week. The headline is, "Face It, Meat Sack, Pro Gamer Will Be the Only Job Left." And they're putting out this kind of view of the future, that we're going to have so much automation, there's not going to be enough employment for everybody. You know, gaming companies already make money when there's a lot of sort of big buyers who come in and pay money to get different kinds of weapons and different kinds of powers, but they're not going to come if they don't have people to play against. So they posit that someday in the future they're going to pay the proles, the sort of us little folk out there, to get in and play so that the big whales will come in and pay money to arm up and win.
That's actually a whole sub-theme of the last William Gibson novel. So it's definitely very much in the realm of science fiction. I think esports, you know, thinking about what's coming at GDC and from some of the callers, competitive gaming is something that I've been, you know, doing this professionally for about 15 years and obviously playing games my whole life. But seeing the growth of esports and this sort of like sudden surge in interest, interest from marketers, mm-hmm. interest from, let's say, radio hosts, interest from newspapers, is very interesting to me, because what you end up having is an industry that has been around for a long time, esports, competitive gaming, and it has suddenly hit a tipping point where it's impossible to ignore, where suddenly, you know, I think it was 4 years ago that the League of Legends World Championship sold out the Staples Center in record time.
Can you describe an esports competition for people who aren't plugged into this? Do they think of the Super Bowl, or they think of NBA basketball, or you know, watching baseball? But esports and the spectator part of it, in addition to the pro player part, describe the whole scene.
So you're watching a competitive game of, let's say, League of Legends. It's in a giant arena somewhere. It's lit up like a Vegas show fight.
And all the players are there at the 50-yard line or whatever?
Yep. They're lined up in the middle. They're on computers sitting. You know, let's say for this specific game, they're on computers.
Giant monitors, obviously.
Yeah, the arena's run in giant monitors. And what the players are watching is a combination of the game itself, the video game. They're watching cutaway shots of the players themselves and the casters, the people that are actually sort of doing the play-by-play, who are a huge part of how you understand the game.
Right.
The experience that you're watching is something that is different than athleticism, the way we think about it, right? You see somebody do a slam dunk, and I can't do that. That's impressive.
Yeah,
I'd like to watch that again. You watch somebody do something in an esport. Number one, most of these games are available for you to purchase. They're free to play, usually. Like, you can just go play it. You can recognize a skill that you yourself don't have, or a move that you couldn't have pulled off, or coordination that you didn't have with your team or your players. So the thing you're watching is hard to parse without a lot of fluency in the actual mechanics of the game. And so it can be off-putting for people who don't play the game or don't follow. But the people who do follow are watching something that is being played at a very high level.
Vicariously watching, playing along, or seeing, oh, wow, look at that move.
Yep. And I think, you know, the analogy I usually use, which is easy to understand, is chess. If you're fluent in the rules of chess, you can watch a game between two chess masters, and it's very thrilling, it's very engaging, because you understand the rule set. You understand when somebody's been checkmated. If you don't understand the rule set of chess, it looks like two people pushing pieces across a board.
But the idea
it's not very exciting.
Yeah, but filling the Staples Center is just amazing to watch esports. But yet, you're right, it's a very happening thing. Here's a little sound from L.A. This is just October last year, the League of Legends World Championship Finals, one of the top grossing video games in the world, $1.6 billion earned in 2015. Here's a scene from that final match where Team SK Telecom played Team Samsung Galaxy, and two announcers there, known as shoutcasters, give the play-by-play.
Here comes Ambition!
Ambition's running in, gravity fields up. That will stun Ambition under the tower. Kill is secured, but Ambition loses his life.
Bengi got inexperienced range there, and he's going to be able to take up these minions.
Here's Wolf Roaring! More action!
Here comes Bengi, and Wolf Crown's going to sidestep and dodge. He will get stunned up by the concussive blows. SK Telecom, 3-1.
League of Legends World Championship Finals, kind of incredible. There it is, spectator sport and pros playing. Keenan in Tampa, Florida. Our time is short. Keenan, what do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm thinking about the financial part of a streaming, live streaming, and it really pertains to esports, like your audience here. He was talking about how, like, you can watch someone play chess, and if they're very, very good at it, you kind of learn all the different tasks that they're going through and kind of get an idea of what's going through their head. And there's people on this website called Twitch. It's the 50th top site in the world.
Amazon owns it. You can watch people playing, sort of look over their shoulder as they play.
Right. And so there's professional players that also are part of teams that play in esports that will stream their video game as they're playing it. And thousands of people can watch them and kind of take what they're doing and apply it to their own play. But people donate to these people, and they get advertising money, and they get sponsorships, and it's a very, very large financial market.
Is this where we're going? Keenan, I appreciate your call. Chris Grant, what's the evolutionary arc that we're on here? How do you see this expressing itself or the role these video games will play in American lives as we move further into this century?
You know, I think you're looking at even organizations like professional sports leagues. The NBA partnered with 2K for NBA 2K to make an actual competitive video game basketball league. You have the Philadelphia 76ers purchase two esports teams and merge them into one. Like, you're seeing an actual recognition from the actual professional sports world that esports are real and that the audience for sports isn't getting any younger, and that if they want to remain competitive, that there is a future where esports could become, you know, quote unquote, real sports. I'll put scare quotes around that. But and I think the professionalization of esports is what we're seeing. And the reason we're seeing this kind of sudden surge in interest from marketers and advertisers is that everyone's eager for this professionalization to happen so that they can monetize it, to the last caller's point.
The business folk are eager for the monetization here. But we've heard in this hour about how so many things come together here. It's sort of like reading. It's sort of like sports. It's very much like social media. Personal experiences more and more being evident here. The kind of indie realm as well. Twitch, you can look right over somebody's shoulder and play alongside. Amazing, exploding world, and it just keeps going. Chris Grant at Polygon. Chris, thank you very much for joining us from San Francisco today.
Thanks.
Danielle Riendo at Waypoint, Vice's Guide to Gaming. Thank you, Danielle, for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. This is fun.
And Frank Guan at Vulture, who got us all started. Thanks so much, Frank.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with League of Legends Piercing Light. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.